The Breckshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Hello and welcome to another stonking episode of the Blackshaw Arts Hour.
Well, it's a bit premature calling it stonking already, surely.
Hey, you've got to have confidence in your work, Matt Boothman. Welcome, Matt Boothman.
Hi.
Hello. I'm Ellie. We're the usual two. Is that going to be our name now?
Sure, the usual suspects.
No, that's been taken.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We've got lots of things coming up. We've got a film review of Mother. We've got some chat about Angels in America, that show that was on at the National that was super duper long.
Yeah.
We are going to talk a little bit about our upcoming Scare Slam. We've also got some very exciting chat about female playwrights and other ladies what work in the theatre.
Yeah, general gender balance survey review of the industry.
That is a catchy title. Let's stick with that. So coming up, before we start the big things, let's talk about the other things, which is we are moving our time slots on Wandsworth Radio. We will no longer be on Sunday evenings. As of now, we are on Tuesdays at the witching hour.
If you're listening live, thank you for finding us in our new time slot. And why aren't you in bed?
Yeah, so I'm hoping that we're going to open ourselves up to a whole new audience of shift workers and insomniacs.
Hell yeah.
So we start at midnight and it's every other Tuesday.
Yeah, we are. It's a bold new post-watershed world for the Blackshaw Arts Hour.
We might do a swearsies. Might.
We're not in the habit.
No, but if it slips out, it's not so bad because it's late time.
Yep. And so also if you're a podcast subscriber, you'll start noticing that the podcast appears in your podcatching software on a Tuesday instead of on a Sunday.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes, that is all the days correctly named. All two of them. Great. So business over. On to the first exciting thing, which of course is our film review.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Now, we did actually talk about Mother a little bit last time. So let's see what we had to say. Oh, yeah, Mother! Yes, Mother is... the reason I've skipped over it is because it's already out.
Which is the new Darren Aronofsky with Jennifer Lawrence in the lead, and we don't really know much more about it than that, other than it looks weird.
It looks really scary. The trailers don't give a lot away, apart from the fact that Jennifer Lawrence was presuming in a relationship with what's his chops? Yeah, Javier Bardem. And then there's some kind of a visitor turns up at their door, and Javier's all like, yeah, sure, let the stranger in. And she's a bit like, okay. And then a little bit later, the stranger's wife turns up and she's like, something weird's going on. And then she goes through their luggage and she finds an old-timey picture of Javier. Like he's off of the past. And then he's like, what's the problem? All these people came here to see me. And then some walls like bleed and stuff and she shouts a lot.
Yeah, I mean, Darren Aronofsky, I don't always like his films, but I always feel like he's trying to do something interesting and ambitious with them, even if he doesn't manage it.
So A-star for effort. It'd
be worth trying.
So yeah, I would like to go and see it, but I'm too scared to go and see it on my own, I think, probably. Unless they'd let me have the lights on, but I don't think that they'd generally let that happen. So, Matt, you've now seen the film.
I have.
Have we successfully guessed at what the film was about?
We weren't a million miles away. The thing about the old-timey photo is a little bit of a red herring. Or the fact of it being a bit old-timey looking is.
Okay.
So I'm going to spoil all the things.
Yay!
Because I think everybody who was going to go and see this film has seen it already.
Okay, so I should put in a honk spoiler alert.
Maybe.
Honk spoiler alert.
Yeah, so I'm going to... And I'm going to follow up that honk spoiler alert with some content warnings for infanticide and cannibalism.
Okay, awesome. So if you're of a
there's your first spoilers right there.
If you're of a nervous disposition, maybe just fast forward this bit.
Yep. So the setup is, as we saw in the trailer, Jennifer Lawrence is the young wife of Javier Bardem, who is a poet.
Yeah.
They're never named. He's the poet. She is Mother.
Great.
They live in his childhood home, which burned down when he was a child,
right,
and which she, presumably at some unspecified point after them getting together, has lovingly restored from the ground up.
That's nice of her. Was it, I mean, destroyed, like, completely burned down?
Like, burned to blackened shell of a house.
Okay. Doesn't sound very structurally sound.
She has made it so.
That's good. Good job, Jennifer Lawrence.
So he sits at his desk and racks his brain for his next poem while she does all the plastering and the repointing and the flooring and the plumbing.
She's smashing gender norms.
Yeah, sort of. Except that it seems like she's poured so much of herself into the house and all her work on the house that it has, to some extent, metaphorically or actually, become an extension of her and of her body.
Okay.
She seems to have some sort of, like, affinity with the house. When, as we see in the trailer, people other than the two of them start turning up, fans of his poetry start turning up.
Oh, so they're the people, that's why those people arrive?
Yeah, it's a mystery to start with.
Yeah.
They appear to just be random passers-by seeking shelter.
Mm.
But they are there for him.
Okay.
And for his work. And she's very uncomfortable with the invasion of their space by people who have shown up unannounced and are their motives are sort of unknown and they're kind of uncouth. But he overrides her. Partly because he likes the attention and the adulation of fans who like his work, and partly because the house is her body and women don't get to make choices about their bodies. Get it?
Oh, big metaphor.
Yeah. So it starts with that kind of prickling social horror of randomers coming into your carefully maintained house.
Yeah, I mean, that makes me feel pretty anxious.
And messing up your stuff.
No.
Being dirty.
Use a coaster.
Breaking things and just generally being disrespectful of your space. And the fact that the expectation of you as a host, even if you never wanted them there in the first place, is that you can't just tell them off and say, this is not on, you're getting out of my house now, without coming off as kind of stiff or ungracious.
Right.
Especially when your husband wants them there and won't let you tell them
to leave.
Sounds
like all kinds of awkward.
Yep. And even when they get weirdly, blatantly rude about things. Mm. So Michelle Pfeiffer and Ed Harris are the couple that turn up, and they are rude to Jennifer Lawrence in ways that are not just bad house guests. Like you start to get the sense there's some malice behind it.
Oh, okay.
Malice aforethought. They bring in into this sort of pristine home, this pristine, peaceful place. They bring their own family drama and they eventually bring violence. And he's only concerned with being a good host and he's flattered by all their attention. Nothing she does is good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that we've seen that she's done all the hard work around the house while he sits there being an intellectual. As more people start arriving and things start accelerating and it gets beyond those first two, she starts being treated basically like a servant. All her hard labour on the house is disregarded and disparaged. And of course the work on the house is work on herself,
she's linked
because
to
she
the,
is the house,
yeah,
effectively.
Okay.
And all of that work is to satisfy him.
Right.
Because it's his childhood home that she's restored.
Yeah.
All that work is disparaged while he just basks in the adulation of all the people arriving.
This is sounding like a lot of lady man politics.
Yeah. Until, there's more, she has his baby.
Okay.
And that's enough. That's a thing that she can get respect for, because that's what women can do.
That's what we're made for.
Yeah, that's what women can do that will get them respect
okay.
The same sort of respect as a man
God
gets
forbid
for his
you're
intellectual pursuits.
Motherless, not a, no wait, not motherless, childless.
So yeah, it's like yeah, okay, yeah. Women's work, women's labor is underappreciated, and work on the house and
that is a thing.
Sort of thing is underappreciated, while men get heaped with praise for little intellectual achievements.
Or emptying the dishwasher for once.
Yep. People think childbearing is the only worthwhile thing a woman could do. Yeah, it's like, yeah, I don't disagree with all of this stuff that the movie is saying.
Mm-hmm.
so that everybody coming into the house wants a piece of him, and things just start generally accelerating and getting more and more crazy pants banana hammocks until they are all, it turns into basically a mob who are stealing things to have a memento of him, and breaking things in order to have a memento. And of course, what they're stealing isn't really bits of him, it's bits of her, because she's the house, remember?
She's the house. It sounds so stressful.
It is. It's weird. As it gets crazier and crazier and crazier, and that, like, more people turn up, and the destruction starts to get beyond that initial social satire and become more heightened and more fantasy sequence type of thing, like, it gets to the point where there's effectively like a war going on in the house between rival factions of people interpreting his poems different ways and interpreting the word of the poet. So I enjoyed that in a kind of like the same way you appreciate a sort of mad music video.
Sure.
So it felt like it should have been ramping tension, but there's a point where it tips over into being so heightened and so fantastical that you end up kind of sitting outside of it.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there sort of chuckling to myself because it was so mad. I was enjoying how mad it was.
Do you partly think it's because, you know, the characters don't have names, they don't seem to behave like normal people, so you haven't really identified with them as characters in the same way you would in a less insane film? So you're not really feeling, I don't know, like the usual sort of fear for their safety, and you're not invested in them living and prospering?
Partly, yeah. I think by that point, if you haven't got the sense that this is a more of a metaphor than a story of this person, then the film has not hammered your head sufficiently hard, and I don't know what to tell you, because it hammers your head pretty hard.
Okay.
And just in case you don't get the whole thing about them wanting everything from wanting to hold him up on a pedestal and only appreciating her for her child rearing abilities. Mm-hmm. They go ahead and they eat her baby.
They eat the baby.
They eat the baby in a sort of ritualistic, like, we are taking part of the poet into our bodies way.
Though I am out of this film.
Yeah. I think it's a massive own goal, because there are, you could just, it is a kind of, by that point it's clear it's an art movie rather than, I think the trailer's kind of made it out to be a horror movie.
Well, it looks like a commercial horror. So it's going to be like, remember with Drive? I remember you saying that the trailer for Drive made it look like it was going to be a kind of racing car movie, kind of like the Fast and Furious franchise. But then, of course, it is. It's very arty, much more slow-moving film.
Very, yeah.
So are they going to get people who've gone to see it thinking it's one thing, and they're like, this is not my kind of film at all?
Yeah. So it's an art movie. It has a point to make. Like I said, it kind of makes that point, and I don't disagree with the points that it's making, but now it's the movie where they eat the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's...
They Sarah Kane'd it.
Yeah, kind of. I was thinking of Sarah Kane as I was watching, actually, specifically.
Yeah.
The act break in Blasted, where it goes from being a tight two-hander in a hotel room to suddenly the war comes in, and it's this big sprawling war thing. Mm-hmm. Definitely got shades of that.
And then the super gross stuff.
Yes.
Because in that, a soldier eats his own eyes, doesn't he?
He eats someone else's
eyes. He eats someone's eyes.
Yeah, he sucks out someone's eyes and eats them.
Because he thinks it'll make him be able to see again because he's blind.
Yes. I'd forgotten that element to it. But yeah.
If anyone doesn't know, Sarah Kane is a playwright.
Yes.
And well known for kind of shocking stuff.
She shook up theatre of her time.
Now I mean, that's just pedestrian stuff, right?
It was In Your Face Theatre, I think, is the name of the movement, or the name that was applied to the movement afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I was almost willing to give it the benefit of the doubt, because, like I said, I don't disagree with the messages that it's putting across, and as things get more crazy and she is the only person saying what's going on here is ridiculous, like, she is the audience's point of view. Mm. She's the only one who can see that things have gone way off the rails crazy pants.
Well, someone ate her child, so it's bad.
And as it's accelerating, you start to get the sense that her keeping her composure is all that's stopping the house from disintegrating back into that blackened, burned out shell.
Because she is the house.
Because she's the house. So there are moments where she starts to lose her cool and you start to see bits of the wall and floor reverting back to that burned state. And by about halfway through, I was ready to stand up and just yell at the screen, just let it all burn down.
Yeah.
Just stop trying to keep your composure. Let all of these people get incinerated and,
right.
and go. And to her, to the credit of the story, she does attempt to leave around that point,
mm-hmm.
But is prevented by various things. What I'm relieved about with it is that it does deliver on that, and it does go there in the end.
Okay.
So I've said spoilers. She does.
She burns it down.
She blows up the house at the end. She blows up herself and the house and everyone in it.
Yeah.
And that's where the movie ends, and there isn't an epilogue that makes it all rubbish.
Okay.
Which is great, because if there was a smug epilogue afterwards, then it wouldn't be her story anymore. And I think the only thing it's got going for it is that there's that typical story of the tortured artist and their supportive spouse.
Mm.
And generally when movies have gone there in the past, they focus on him, the tortured artist, and his journey and his pain.
Yeah.
And this is a story of that relationship that's all focused on her and the effect on her of being ignored and of her labour being underappreciated and of everybody pouring all their affection on him and ignoring her and expecting her to do things. And she snaps at the end and kills them all, and it's really, really satisfying.
Good.
And it's great that there then isn't an epilogue after the exploding that makes it all about him again and retroactively puts him at the centre of the story. And
I feel like there is, though.
Makes her even less of like a person and more of just like a prop or a metaphor
that he's created.
That
is that a thing that happens?
I mean, if
are
it
you
did...
saying that if the film had ended there, you'd be okay?
I mean, if it had an epilogue like that, I'd definitely have stomped home quite angry from the cinema and lost all benefit of the doubt I was willing to give the movie.
Sure, I think I got a message from you shortly after you'd seen the film, which indicates that maybe the bad thing happened.
Yeah, the bad thing happened.
Oh, what happened?
So it has a satisfying ending, and then it goes on for another 2 minutes that it shouldn't have done, and it throws away any goodwill I was kind of willing to give it.
What happens?
Full spoilers. It turns out he was God or something.
Sure.
And it had all happened before. And he, like, takes the love that she still has for him even after everything and recreates the house from it. So it's not even her that recreates the house.
Oh.
It's him. He puts the house back together with, like, love magic.
Okay.
And another version of her wakes up, but it's not Jennifer Lawrence anymore. So it's just, like,
it's
this
just
sequence
some other woman.
Of people that he's going through. And it's not about... It's
so
not
the whole
her
thing
story
just repeats
anymore.
Itself.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, that sounds awful.
I would not recommend.
I've read an article which gave full spoilers, so I did know most of the kind of stuff you've been talking about in terms of plot. And I did quite early on in that article realise that the whole biblical thing was being, actually, once you look back at it and it's pointed out, is really obvious. That even to the fact that Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer are Adam and Eve, and then the sons they bring with them are Cain and Abel.
So
one kills the other.
I wasn't confident enough in my biblical lore to make that call on whether I thought that's what it was. But when I did see, okay, these two brothers come into the house and one of them kills the other. Didn't that happen in the Bible?
Yes,
maybe
yes,
there's
it
a
did.
Bible thing happening.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you can confirm that.
Yeah, confirmed. and then you've got, so all the people coming to the house are the acolytes. They're God's followers, and they are destroying. So Jennifer Lawrence is apparently representing Mother Nature.
Oh, again,
which
getting all my biblical stuff mixed up.
But also, Mother Nature is not a biblical
something.
Thing, so it's
no.
a bit at odds, because then it's the idea that Mother Nature and God are two separate entities. And if you're going to go down the biblical route, actually, God is all of the things. So there wouldn't be a Mother Nature character. So it's kind of a, it feels like they kind of wanted the two things, the kind of gender messages that you were talking about, and then also the kind of biblical overlay as well. So it's certainly, and I think probably the kind of overarching moral they want us to get is, like, look after the earth, because maybe there isn't a do-over.
Yeah.
Like we put at the end of this film. So I mean,
it sounds like they made a film with, or Darren Aronofsky made a film with this grand biblical analogy in mind, and he sort of accidentally made a film onto which I can read
your own
a reading that I don't disagree with.
Yes, and one that is kind of, I would say, maybe somewhat more relevant,
potentially, or like more universally
applicable. Yeah. And then, the other biblical link is that obviously her baby is Jesus.
Oh, of course, yeah, I vaguely got that.
So that's why he gets killed and eaten, because communion is eating Jesus.
Yeah.
It's just, I just think it's garbage. I just think this film is just utter garbage, and I think I'm really sad about the fact that apparently Jennifer Lawrence is now dating Darren Aronofsky, and I feel like maybe he's just kidnapped her. She's got some kind of weird Stockholm syndrome going on.
She put herself through some stuff filming this.
Yeah, she broke a rib, didn't she?
Dislocated a rib, hyperventilating, what? Filming one of the scenes.
No.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said in the clip you played from the last show, the thing I will say for him is he at least is always trying to do something.
Mm.
And there were other films out that week that I could have seen that I think my reaction would have been, you know, it's all right. It's a blockbuster. It follows the formula. So I appreciate that it doesn't follow the formula. And I had an emotional reaction to it, and it gives me something to talk about.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's good.
No, it's not good that you paid that money and spent that time watching a film that made you so angry.
Spoilers end.
Spoilers end. But I think the long and short of it is, would not recommend.
No.
Yeah. Any thoughts on what you might see next time?
Blade Runner 2049.
Yes, I'm really pleased about this. I haven't seen the original Blade Runner for ages, so I think I might watch that in advance of going to see the new one.
I think that, yeah, I kind of want to do that as well. And you have to pick which cut you're going to watch, though.
Oh.
There's about 5 different cuts floating around on different DVD editions.
Okay.
Just watch the one you've got, or whichever one you can get your hands
on. Yeah, okay, good.
But yeah, it's supposed to be pretty good. I'm trying to avoid too many comments, but all the ones I've accidentally seen scrolling past on my Twitter timeline are pretty positive.
Okay, I'm quite looking forward to the combo of Harrison Ford and Ryan Gosling. Yeah,
I'm looking forward to Denis Villeneuve's take on the look of the world of Blade Runner.
Right.
I liked his work on Arrival.
Awesome. Okay, well, I look forward to that. We're now going to segue into a conversation about theatre. This is all about Angel in America, which was showing at the National not long ago.
More biblical overtones, but better this time.
Okay, good. The other things we wanted to talk to you about were you and Matt about Angels in America, because you've seen both parts now and it's obviously finished.
Yeah,
but we only had a little teaser chat with Matt about it after part one.
Yeah, and it's a shame we couldn't get. It's a shame Helen wasn't free, because she's seen both parts and she had the experience of seeing both parts on the same day.
Oh gosh, that was a long day.
Whereas we saw them what, 2-3 months apart?
Yeah, it was quite a
gap, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I suppose there's downsides to having a big gap as well, because it's not as fresh in your mind. And they presumably don't start by being like previously
on Angels in America. No,
oh my god, can you imagine if they did?
Yeah.
Montage.
I mean, the one of the ways that we were thinking about it was, I think that's how they were originally produced.
Yeah.
Like
with
the first
gap.
The first time it was staged, there was a gap between when you could see parts one and two. So we got the OG experience.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic show.
Yeah.
And fantastic production of a friend. I'd not seen it staged before and was only sort of passingly familiar with the material. I don't know about you.
I'd seen part one at university.
Yes.
And so had that kind of slight, the first part was a lot of familiarity of kind of like, oh, I remember this bit. So I really enjoyed part two as a kind of entirely new thing. And I think a lot of things came together that any niggles you had about the first part were kind of, the staging was kind of a little bit odd with these lighted tubes that kind of created little compartments. Because actually you realise that Angels in America is a lot of duologues, basically. Mm. It's, you know, a series of them one after another. But actually the second part, you realise how huge the Lilton stage is, and it kind of became a bit more epic. with a lot of it.
Like the first part's basically staged on the Littleton stage on like three different separate revolves.
Yeah.
Like so they've got a different, literally a different scene, a different set each time.
Yeah, so lots of stuff moving about, but all quite conceptual and like geometric shapes and neon rather than sort of naturalistic spaces, but with naturalistic set dressing, desks and stuff. And then it gets, like, it's a very conceptual play in places, and it gets more conceptual in the staging as it goes along. So you get sort of their take on heaven and all sorts.
I think that's why I enjoy part two more, because they're fully embracing the conceptual things. If you've just kind of alluded to it more in the first part, and then it's kind of, you know, this is what we're going with. Like,
plump
just fully,
for one or the other guys.
Fully get into it.
Yeah, who needs naturalism?
Exactly.
This is the stage. You can do anything. Anything can be real, so let's have everything.
I mean, really, with that cast, he doesn't really need saying that they're amazing.
Yeah.
Nathan Lane particularly was a highlight, I think, for me.
Is he the one off of Heroes? No,
he's out of The Lion King. He is Timon or Pumba.
Oh my god.
Timon. He's Timon out of
But
The Lion
King. But he's also
in
Modern Family.
He's in so many things. And he's a consummate character.
As soon as you see him, you're going
to
go,
oh my god.
Yeah, he's in The Good Wife.
He's a very subtle
character.
He's a wonderful character. Yeah.
But playing a total gangster in this, like the celebrity lawyer. Who feels like he's untouchable and always has three phones in his hand and six different people on hold, wheeler dealer.
Yeah.
And so he has the famous line in it that like when he's told that he's HIV positive, that he tells the nurse or the doctor, sorry, who gives him the diagnosis, gay people get that. I've got liver cancer. And that's the public story that he sells everybody else. And he's got that kind of that almost like reality warping personality that you believe that he can make people believe that.
Yeah. And he was based on a real person. He's the kind of the one person I think that is based on a real life person who's quite formidable in real life. I think Andrew Garfield is the one that's been getting a lot of the headlines as being the kind of slightly attention-grabbing.
Is that because people have gone, oh, he can do more than just Spider-Man?
Yeah, possibly. I don't know, he's just a very emotional and kind of like, because he plays the campest character that's always, and has a number of the funniest lines, I think.
Absolutely, he gets all the best lines.
Yeah, he does get the best lines.
But he's the one who's most tapped into the religious side of the sort of the themes of the play.
Yeah, the angel.
In that he is the prophet.
Yeah, yeah. And Russell Tovey gets his bum out again. I mean, I think it's
literally can't go a minute.
Does he have trousers?
I'm not sure.
I think he just doesn't bother.
Why would you if you've got a bottom like that?
Yeah.
I mean, no denying, but it definitely was like, okay, that's happening again.
Was that the only nudity?
Yes. Yes. Yes, I think it was.
And you only got his back bottom.
Yes. He is fully nude, but you only get him from the back, yes. Yeah. And it's quite nice to see, because I'm used to seeing him playing quite sort of emotionally open characters and in things like Being Human. And he is the very repressed character who has to open up to get in touch with his feelings in this, and who has to sort of struggle with the conflict between what he knows he's feeling and what he's been brought up to believe as a Mormon. So it's good to see that he's got that range, and to see him be allowed to play quite a would it be horrible wordplay to say straight laced? Because he's totally in the closet.
No, that's just a pun, isn't it?
I realised I was about to say it and thought, should I do this?
No, I think if you picked it initially and subconsciously, then it's okay.
No, I think it sounds fantastic. I don't know if I personally have the ability to have... I wouldn't be able to watch them both in one day, I don't think. So I don't know. I have to ask Helen how she...
It's just too much theatre.
It's a lot. It's just a lot of intensity.
But I was in awe of how they managed to act it in one day.
Yeah.
I mean, it is.
And
like
keep it both in their heads. Like, that's a lot of... Like, I'm always kind of in awe of people just doing long plays with...
Yeah, you're basically in two shows at once, right? Like, fundamentally.
Yeah, and it's not just the words that they're all keeping in mind, because it's such... it's naturalistic dialogue, but in a stylized way, if that makes sense. That it's got all of the false starts and the pauses and the talking over yourself that natural speech has, and it's got a really interesting scripting style because of that. So it means you're not just remembering words, but you're remembering. So he starts the sentence like this, and then he starts it again, and he false starts and talks over himself, and it's very fragmented.
Well,
I'm exhausted just thinking.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Well, if any more epics come up at the National or elsewhere, then we should endeavour to have some of us see it, I guess.
And for any listeners over the Atlantic in America, Angels in America is, of course, going to America.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
It's
going to be on Broadway next year.
Existing cast?
I imagine they'll be keeping
predominantly,
I
would think. Yeah.
It's interesting because a lot of the cast have done a lot of film and TV, so you kind of wonder about their schedules.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a big commitment, isn't it, for not being able
but
to
great.
Do a lot else.
I mean, I know pretty much all of them, when being interviewed in the run-up to it, were saying how much they were enjoying being back in a theatre rather than being behind a camera, so. So thanks to Sinead for coming in and talking about that with our very own Matt Boothman.
That's me. I'm here this time as well.
That's right, Matt Boothman, you are. Okay, so we are now going to have a little quick chat about the upcoming Blackshaw show. It's our very own Scare Slam.
It's going to be spooky.
Ooh. It's at the London Horror Festival at the Old Red Lion Theatre on Monday the 23rd of October at 7 p.m. You coming, Matt?
I am coming.
Excellent. I'm really looking forward to it. The tickets are on sale now. They are £10 full price, £8 concession, and you can get them at the London Horror Festival website or the Old Red Lion website or our website, blackshaw9.com. Go to all three websites. Go crazy.
Give everyone all the hits.
All of the hits.
Buy a ticket from each one. Why not?
Why not? So, essentially, it's like a poetry slam, except instead of poets standing up and doing a slam, it's people doing scary stories.
I mean, poets aren't excluded.
That's true.
You could.
We've had poetry before.
You can do poems.
You can do poems as long as they're scary.
Cool.
But it's not all poems. It will be a mixture of sort of extracts from novels or anecdotes of things that have actually real life scary happened. I told a couple of those last year. Sort of dramatic readings, all things.
If you've listened to The Moth, think that, but exclusively about scary stuff.
Cool. So if you fancy that, come on down, book yourself a ticket for the 23rd of October. And if you want to sort of check out what you might be in for, you can listen to last year's Scare Slam on this very podcast. It's episode 51. So you can find that wherever you found this. Now we're going to listen to a little extract from last year's Scare Slam, in fact. This is the wonderful Molly Beth Morosa.
Being a child is a wonderful thing. You can run, you can jump, you can laugh, dance and sing. Endless fun can be had and whole days you can spend just laughing and joking and japing with friends. But Lucy Malloy never had so much luck. She was always alone, by herself. She was stuck in a hollow old house with her games and her toys where she tried to block out all the fuss and the noise. The boys and the girls all thought Lucy was queer. They'd laugh, and they'd point, and they'd snarl, and they'd jeer. No, Lucy was happiest when left on her own, in her room, playing tea party, quiet, alone. Alone save her toys who'd attend her soirees. Her dolls and her bears would all sit there for days. More tea, Mr. Squeaks, the mouse kindly declined. It is a great party, old Ted. You're too kind. Her mother and father were very concerned. So they went to the doctor, and when they returned, they explained to her, Lucy, the doc recommends that you go out and be nice and try to make friends. Making friends? Well, the idea made her uneasy. Well, that's putting it lightly. It made her feel queasy. It was all just too much. It drove her around the bend when faced with the prospect of making a friend. No, she'd much rather stay where they wouldn't make fun. They'd call her a freak, They'd throw stones and they'd run. No, staying alone seemed a much better scheme. She'd pour pretend tea, spread pretend scones with cream. One day, as she handed her stuffed cat a cup, Lucy felt quite unwell, and without looking up, she could sense there was now someone sat to her right. As dread thumped in her veins, her eyes snapped shut tight. "Hello, Lucy. I'm Evelyn," a sweet, soft voice cooed. "May I have some tea? I don't mean to intrude." Carefully opening one of her eyes, there she saw a young girl. Much to her surprise, Lucy blinked blankly, quite stricken with awe, see where Evelyn was now. She had not been before. Evelyn looked strange, looked a faint shade of blue. Her hair dank and dark, her lips purplish in hue. Her smile was too wide and showed needle-like teeth. Her skin paper thin, something moved underneath. Lucy looked in her eyes, large, obsidian, black. And in their reflections, her own eyes stared back. And that's when the teacups all started to crack. And that's when the teacups all started to crack. Now in the asylum and strapped to her bed, the only friends Lucy has are the ones in her head. She has one best friend, always there by her side, holding hands, sipping tea, and smiling too wide.
And also a secondary treat for you all, this is the Skag and Bone Man, performed by Stuart Vincent, written by Stack 10 Theatre.
If you don't go to bed, the Skag and Bone Man will get you. If you don't do your work, the Skag and Bone Man will get you. You'll hear him coming, boot heels crunching on a tower block stairs, bones rattling in his coat pocket. The little bones of bad boys and girls who don't behave and make him cross. You never make the Skag and Bone Man cross. For a week, Younger stood on a tower block stairs, dealing like a good soldier, a good Younger to the Scarboroughs, the glazed-eyed junkies looking more like Haitian zombies rather than criminals and people. And Younger knew what time was coming. His brother Ash already told him, you work a week for them and then they get you robbed. But why? Because they own you. And once they own you, you gotta work all hours a week to pay off that debt, 25 to 8, fam. So Younger worked all week, dealing out that heroin and no cocaine to the Scarboroughs, watching time slip away, second minutes, hours, days. Ash promised him he would be safe. As long as he don't act like a bad man, he'd be fine. He'd get robbed, and that was that. It is what it is. But Younger didn't like the idea of being owned. He was no one's bitch. He wasn't gonna get robbed. Younger had a plan. Friday morning, while Ash was sleeping on Thursday night, Younger crept into his bedroom, opened up his cupboard doors. Underneath a pile of dirty magazines, one to one or make you come, was Ash's 9mm. Yash took the gun, slipped it behind his back, hot and sharp against his flesh. That day, he saw the two rude boys coming a mile off, bopping their way up the stairs, walking that walk as if one leg wasn't working. The two rude boys were talking about one of them local girls. She went to her boyfriend's house the night before. And when she got there, three boys jumped out and she had to give a lineup, part of the initiation. One of the rude boys stopped the conversation to whistle out a Younger. Psst! One of each, bruv. But these weren't no zombies. They didn't have no need in their eyes. The slow, shuffling movements of a clucking junkie, nah. They weren't interested in one of each. They were interested in Younger. Younger slipped one hand behind his back, holding onto the 9mm. The two rude boys were on the same level. One of them grabbed him, went into his pocket to pick out a machete until he was clocked with a 9mm right in his face. Two rude boys stood still. Back up! Put the gun down, bruv. Younger thinking of what to say next. Put the blade back. bruv. I ain't your bitch, I ain't no one's bitch. And I'll shoot you, I swear to God I will. Now put the blade back and walk away. You just made a mistake, little man. He ain't gonna like this. He's gonna come for you himself. Who? The Skag and Bone Man. Younger felt the dread rise up. The floor swam, the eyes blurring around the edges. Younger went back against the wall and dropped to the floor till he looked like a clucking junkie. The Skag and Bone Man. His long coat, black as night, black as pitch, the obsidian black of the ever after that was filled with the bones of the poor bastards who crossed the Skag and Bone Man. You never make the Skag and Bone Man cross. Younger jumped to his feet. He ran up the stairs. The 9mm fell out of his pocket onto the floor. He left it there. What use is a 9mm against the Skag and Bone Man? One step, two step, three step, four step, five step. If he kept moving, maybe he'd be safe. Six step, seven step, back to his flat. Eight step, into his bed. Nine step, underneath the duvet. 10 step, safe. 11 step, nah. Too late. Younger froze. From down below the tower block stairs, Younger heard the footsteps. His footsteps. The boots on the floor crushing the bones beneath him. Younger couldn't move, couldn't force his limbs to obey the overthinking thought of his head screaming, run, run, run! Younger looked over the balcony. Who's there? The bull rogue. Younger's heart skipped a beat. From down below, he saw a hand come into sight and grab onto the railing. The hand was scraped and flayed, beringed with bone-white ice, twisted and wrapped around the fingers, which then was topped with pointed fingernails that clutched onto that railing. Younger ran up the stairs. He slipped. He fell to the floor. He heard the footsteps running up after him, dogs barking, another bone ring snapping. Something flew over Younger's head. It dropped against the wall, and then shards of brick went all over his face. Younger glanced over his shoulder to see the heat haze rising between him and him. Younger tried to speak, but all he could hear was the sound of the children crying and the bones crunching. You seeing duppies? You hearing them hounds yet? You know you're done when you hear them hounds. The hands wrapped around Younger's head pulled his face in. Hot and rancid breath, singed with nicotine, filled up his nose. Should I whistle? You know you're done. No? You want to live? What would you get me to let you live, little man? Younger closed his eyes, trying to speak, but at the same time trying not to vomit. Anything. Anything. What about everything? Tell me something, boy. Do you believe in the soul?
I hope that we'll be seeing you all at the Scare Slam.
For something that's like that, but different.
That's correct. We're going to put that on all the posters now. I have a very interesting segment coming up. This is all about female playwrights. So Matt sent me a very interesting article by Victoria Sadler. Now this is kind of an annual article that Victoria writes, hoping that things might change, but they never do.
It's nice that somebody's gathering data, on, like hard data, yeah, on this stuff, because there's a lot of think pieces that go around about the state of women's writing or men's writing, and it's nice to have some actual figures to be able to say this is the state, and also this is the trend over several years.
Yeah. So to give you some of the stats, it's basically about London theatre and the proportion of female playwrights to male playwrights' work being performed and staged at London theatres. So the kind of best scoring theatre for the last year is the Royal Court. So the artistic director there is Vicky Featherston, and 10 out of the 17 shows were written by women. So that's really good, although it's worth noting that 4 out of the 9 main stage shows were by women. So it's just under 50% on the main stage, but over 50% overall if you include the smaller space so they've got there as well.
Bolstered by the studio shows.
Yeah, exactly. Which I guess is not surprising based on the fact that... that there aren't a huge number of very well-known female playwrights out there, so any female playwrights being staged are likely to be put in kind of emerging artist slots.
Yep. Yeah, there's a narrative that I've seen that male playwrights have their first show on in a studio space or something, and then it's like they've arrived and right. Their next show is much more likely to be in a main space.
So they need to have sort of one under their belt to yeah. be bumped up.
Whereas female playwrights are more likely to be seen as in development for a lot longer.
Right.
This is anecdotal stuff that I've seen female playwrights posting in sort mm-hmm. of long Twitter threads about right. the state of the industry.
Okay. How sad. this is this whole segment is pretty sad. The National, 7 out of their 21 shows.
Yeah,
were
it's not great.
Written by females, so that's a third.
Mm-hmm.
The Young Vic, 2 out of 16.
Yeah.
That is really upsetting. What's most upsetting, though, is that's not even the worst one. Don Mar Warehouse, despite having a female artistic director in Josie Rourke, 0 out of their 9 shows.
Yikes.
Although 2 shows had writing assistants from women.
Okay.
I mean, that
but
doesn't count.
Not top billing, though.
Nope. Nope. The Almeida, 1 out of their 6 shows, although it was an adaptation of The Twilight Zone, which was written by a man.
Okay.
So it's a female written adaptation.
Standing on the shoulders of giant men.
Yeah. I don't know how tall the writer of The Twilight Zone was, but whatever, man. The Old Vic, 0 out of their 5 Ooh. Shows. And notably, says in the article that Kevin Spacey, who used to be the artistic director there, was director at the Old Vic for 10 years, and in his final year, only one of the shows was written by women.
And what? And all the other years, none?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a track record.
It's
that
insane.
Will stand for all time.
So, feeling pretty sad now?
A little bit. So, that I mean, there's changes of artistic director coming that I know of in at least one of those venues.
Oh, really?
So, the Kwame Kweama has just been announced
yes,
as the new artistic director at the Young Vic.
Young Vic, yeah.
So, I think his first season is going to be announced in December or potentially January.
Sure.
I can't remember which. So, it'll be interesting to see what he decides to produce
mm-hmm.
And whether he deliberately addresses this or not.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not the greatest of situations.
No, I'd be really interested to know exactly what the kind of selection process for each of those venues actually is, and kind of whether they take into account the background of the writers. I mean, I'm not saying it should be a tick box exercise, but I wonder sort of how many submissions, if they take submissions, they get that are from female writers and how many from male. Because a lot of people's response to this, if you ever question them, is, oh, well, there's just not that many female writers out there.
Yeah, which is a really easy, trite response
yeah.
to this. I imagine there'll be some element of economics and marketing in it.
Do you think you're less likely to sell a show on an unknown name if it's a woman?
I think the people programming theatre probably think that's the case.
Right. Because I wouldn't be surprised if there's a perception that, it's a female writer, so it'll be about women's issues.
Yeah.
It won't be about something universal that I, as a normal audience member, will want to watch. It'll be about periods.
Yeah.
Or, like, whatever feminism.
Whatever the actual subject matter.
Yeah. Which is ironic, because men have been writing about things that they don't know about for hundreds of years. So why can't women write about things they don't know about?
It's our prerogative.
It's a whole play about male virility. It's a whole play about penile dysfunction that I've
yeah.
written.
I mean, every play by men is
about
to some extent, you know. That's the... I mean, men can't really write. Most male playwrights are just women writing under a pseudonym.
That was definitely true in, like, the 19th century. So, still on the subject of women, you found a couple of articles of interest this week.
Yeah, so not on... moving off the subject of playwrights, just that the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company, has announced its summer 2018 season.
Mm.
And every show in that season is going to be directed by women.
It's so very exciting.
Polly Findlay, Erica Wyman, Fiona Laird, Maria Aberg, and Joe Davis are the five directors who will be doing shows. The statement from the artistic director there, Gregory Doran, made a point of saying this wasn't a deliberate conscious decision.
That's so exciting.
Which is interesting because that's the rhetoric that we always get when it's all men. Mm. We're not being sexist. Mm. We just picked the shows that we thought were best, and they happened to all be by men.
And the same often with casting when it's an all white cast.
Exactly.
Oh, it just happened that way.
So it's nice to see that same rhetoric being turned back and used in the opposite direction. He says they had quote reached a point where those women directors had been with us and had grown and developed. End quote. So they're directors that company has been working with and developing,
which is even better because it's not like they've not come at it going, well, what it wants to do, it's going to be a gimmick, we'll have an all-female directed season, we're going to pick the biggest, best female directors from across the whole spectrum of the industry. They're it's their homegrown talent.
Yeah,
that's so good.
Yeah. Michelle Terry was recently appointed as the new artistic director of the Shakespeare's Globe, replacing Emma Rice. Controversial appointment, because Michelle Terry has never directed, let alone artistic directed.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She's been a performer up to this point. But she's promised, in casting, she's promised a 50-50 gender parity on the stage.
Which for Shakespeare is going to be great.
Yep, that'll be good. And I had one other thing, which is that Marianne Elliott, who's recently left the National Theatre and started her own production company with Chris Harper, Elliott Harper Productions, they've announced their first production is going to be Sondheim's Company, but with the central role of Bobby, taken by Rosalie Craig, so gender swapped from the male Bobby that is in the text with Sondheim's blessing.
Fab. Have they got a venue for that?
I don't know that right now.
Okay, that sounds really interesting.
But that will be 2017.
Yet
to be confirmed venue in autumn 2017.
Cool. I just see so many shows where I'm like, why did that role have to be a man? Like, it's fine if they've already got a balance, but if there's only like two women in the show and then just a huge cast of men, I just think, why did the ensemble have to be all male?
Yeah.
Why did this, like, especially with Shakespeare, I think, well, why does it have to be the Duke of so-and-so? If you set it in the modern day, why can't it be a Duchess? Like, what difference does it make? It's not... No one really cares if things are historically accurate. It's whether the meaning and the original intent of the play still carries across.
Yeah. Especially if you actually enjoy theatre, you go there and you acknowledge that the stuff on the stage is heightened and dramatic and in a theatrical world, and you don't expect every prop to be historically accurate and beautifully perfect.
No.
So why expect that of the casting?
Papier-mâché.
Yeah. It's worth noting also specifically with the gender reversal of Bobby in Company, that I haven't heard whether they're reversing any of the other parts.
Oh, okay.
But if not, that means that it's become queer representation as well.
That would be really good.
Which is another thing that is weirdly lacking in theatre.
Yes, because it's not lacking backstage.
No.
Just in front of stage. All right, well, there's everyone's good old injection of gender gender politics in British theatre for you.
Yeah, don't at us.
No. All opinions expressed here are our own personal opinions. They do not represent, I don't know, they don't represent stuff.
Well, specifically don't at us saying get your politics out of my arts, because they're...
Out of my ears.
Out of my ears. They're inextricably linked. Our politics and your ears and our arts.
Someone famous once said that theatre is holding a mirror up to the audience.
There we go.
So you only have yourselves to blame. Brilliant. Okay, well, that brings us very neatly to the end of this episode. So we will be seeing you next time when I will be talking about one of my favourite things, television.
There's a lot of good television at the moment.
Yes, there is.
Ellie's going to tell you which ones are better than others.
I know. I'm going to have to do some research, which is going to be, oh my gosh, so painful.
Because there's more than you can watch in the hours that you have in your life.
That's
so we
correct.
Need you to tell us which ones are worth prioritising.
We need you to waste your life watching television. Oh my gosh, I wish someone would pay me to do that. I'm going to have so much fun. But for serious research reasons.
Definitely.
Okay, good. Well, we'll talk about TV next time. We'll also be hearing your review, Matt, of the new Blade Runner.
Indeed.
And we'll also be having a Stratton and Alex do art.
Yeah, we will.
And some fancy new jingles. That's right, jingles and stings.
Yeah, we've got a new time slot, and we're going to have all fresh new audio furniture for the comfort of your ears.
That's right. It's going to be like your ear canals are in a squishy armchair.
Yes, it is.
Okay, good. Bye.
Bye.